Hello, this is Gregory Novak. This is The Cunning of Geist, Episode 7. Welcome back. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Hegel and mysticism. Now, I know that's a big word, and it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But being good philosophers, we should start with a definition. And mysticism doesn't have one particular meaning. It can mean many things. It can mean magical. It can mean being mysterious. It can mean being hidden. And also it can mean, and this is the sense that we're going to be getting at, the ability to sense the divine within. And again, if you don't like the word divine, you can use spirit or mind or Geist within. Now, Hegel believed that mysticism was this last definition, the sense of Geist within, or the sense of the divine. And he even quoted that. And for those in the Hegel study group, it's paragraph number 722, page 437, in the Miller translation of the Phenomenology of Spirit. The question is, was Hegel a mystic? And under this definition that we've just covered, I believe you can say that he was. As a matter of fact, the priest Fred Copplestone calls Hegel's brand of mysticism rational mysticism. And he did this in a beautifully well-written essay called Hegel and the Rationalization of Mysticism, which appears in New Studies in Hegel's Philosophy, Steinkraust, editor, 1971. However, and this is the sole reason behind doing this particular episode, some believe that Hegel was part of the Hermetic tradition. In other words, that Hegel was just another person in a long line of Hermetic thinkers. And probably the work that has gotten the most attention in this area is the relatively recent book by Glenn McGee called Hegel and the Hermetic Tradition. And it's interesting in this book, McGee claims that Hegel is in fact not a philosopher and that in fact he is a Hermetic thinker. As a matter of fact, the very first sentence in the book is that Hegel is not a philosopher, which is kind of interesting. So what is a Hermetic thinker? What is Hermetic thinking? This episode will review this in a lot of detail. First, there are many different schools and approaches to Hermetic thought, and we're going to be going into detail, into several of the main areas in this type of thinking. And I will explore, first of all, the area which I call the mystery schools. And these are organizations that teach basically some form of hidden knowledge to initiates. The second area I'll be covering is Gnosticism, which is also considered mystical. And also there are many different branches of Gnosticism, but I'll be getting into this in more detail. And then lastly, Kabbalah, which is the form of Jewish mysticism. And we'll be going into this in, as I said, in detail. Now, Hegel himself believed in mysticism in terms of sensing the divine spark within us or sensing Geist within us. However, I do disagree with McGee that Hegel, I believe, was very much a philosopher and didn't consider himself to be a Hermetic thinker, although there are strands of that in Hegelianism for certain. But he was very much a philosopher in the tradition of Plato, Aristotle, and Kant. And he's just not, as I said before, another Hermetic thinker. So let's get into each of these areas. First of all, we'll start with mystery schools. And I'll be specifically focusing in on one particular school, which is called the Rosicrucian Order. And for the study of Gnosticism, we'll be looking at a more recent work, Gnostic work, if you will, A Course in Miracles. And then thirdly, for the Jewish Kabbalah, we'll be looking specifically at Lurianic mysticism, Lurianic Kabbalah, which comes from Isaac Luria, the 16th century mystic from Israel. So let's back up and go into the Rosicrucian Order in more detail, and mystery schools in general. First of all, there's a common core belief among mystery schools that there is out there hidden knowledge that is handed down to initiates of the mystery school. And that's the basic premise, that there's knowledge that is not out there, that's not available to the general public. And it can only be gained by joining one of these mystery schools or associating with one of these schools. And that in most cases, they believe that this knowledge has been passed down for millennia. Rosicrucianism in particular is interesting. Hegel actually refers to it in his Philosophy of Religion, and it appears that he had some familiarity with Rosicrucianism. He referred to the symbol of the rose and the cross, which is where the word Rosicrucian comes from, rose and cross. And that's a symbol of the Christian cross with a rose right in the center. And that can be a symbol of a lot of what we were talking about here, which is the rose represents light, life, and love, and that appears within the confines of the finite world. So the rose grows within a finite world, which is essentially dead. So that's the symbol. And the Rosicrucians believe that their school started way back in Egypt under Pharaoh Akhenaten. Some believe that he was, in fact, the world's first monotheist. He taught a different religion than the religion of his predecessor, Pharaohs, and he believed in one god, the sun god, I guess he called it. And after his death, they reverted back to the old religion. But he can lay claim to being one of the first people on the planet to advocate some form of monotheism. And the Rosicrucians teach that the school that he started continued on. And even though he died and they went back to the other religion, certain members that were alive at his time kept the teaching going. And they added to it, they studied, they learned, and that finally the Egyptian mystery school was taken over by the Greeks, the early Greeks. And the Rosicrucian order teaches that a number of the early Greeks were members of mystery schools and learned it from the knowledge from Egypt. And they, for example, believe that Thales and Pythagoras, they were initiates in the mystery school. And so the teaching went forward, and they do believe that stuff was added to the teaching as it went through the centuries. It eventually reached the Middle Ages. It survived as alchemy, which, as Carl Jung talked a lot about, it wasn't just a bunch of people trying to make gold in their castles. It was actually an effort to try to change human behavior and become something better. They used gold as a euphemism to improve. So it reached Europe in the Middle Ages, and the Rosicrucians claim a lot of people during the Middle Ages and the Reformation were Rosicrucians. They claim Roger Bacon, Francis Bacon, they claim was the head of it for a while. They also claim Jacob Boehme, Descartes, Pascal, Spinoza, Newton, Leibniz, and many others. They claimed that these people were all initiates in the Rosicrucian order. Now, whether they were or not, that's certainly debatable. Also, Napoleon supposedly was the imperator of the Rosicrucian order for a while. Again, whether that was, there's any basis in fact, who knows? But that's what they claim. And then the Rosicrucian teachings went across the Atlantic to America, And they claim that Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Paine were all Rosicrucians. And it continued to thrive, oftentimes in secrecy, because the teachings went against the established church. But it continued. And they also believe something interesting, that it goes through periods of externality where there's an outreach to everybody, and then it goes underground, if you will, for 100 years or so, and it's just passed on from initiate to initiate. The person that brought it back in this cycle of Rosicrucianism was an individual named H. Spencer Lewis, who was initiated into the order in France in 1909 and came back to America and started the American Rosicrucian Order, and started producing monographs that he would send out, and he would advertise on the radio and advertise in magazines. As a matter of fact, if you're old enough, you may remember back in the 1950s and 60s, you would often see ads for the Rosicrucian Order in mainstream publications like Popular Mechanics, etc. Woody Allen even did a joke in one of his movies. I believe it was Annie Hall, and somebody asked him if he was a Rosicrucian, and he said no, he would never believe in a religion that advertised in Popular Mechanics. Anyway, funny joke, but let's talk about what some of the key concepts are of Rosicrucianism. It's many. As I mentioned in the first episode, I did receive Rosicrucian monographs for many years. I never joined. I never was an initiate. Never went to a meeting. But I did. You could receive monographs every week, and I did for many years. And I found that it was very interesting. They covered a lot of things. They covered Greek philosophers, things in science, etc. And I'm not going to get into all that now. But one of their cornerstone concepts is the notion of nous, which is a Greek word meaning mind or spirit, and they. That's essentially to them what's driving things. That to them is what we're referring to here as Geist, mind or spirit. They also pay a lot of attention to the law of three, the affirming, the denying, and the reconciling. There's a similarity to that to some of Hegel's work. As you know, we went into detail last time that Hegel did not say thesis, antithesis, synthesis. But oftentimes you can find a triadic approach in Hegel's work, although you cannot say that was his method at all, as we've covered before. The Rosicrucians also talk a lot about the cosmic or the will of the cosmic, and that again corresponds, I believe, to Hegelianism in terms of the march of history, the cunning of Geist. And they also importantly talk about the master within, that we have a master within, that we can get in touch with the cosmic, with nous within us, and they have exercises and things to do that can help one get in touch with that. So that's their mystical approach, and it's probably similar to many other organizations, initiatory organizations that preach mystery school teachings and the like. Okay, moving on now. Let's talk about Gnosticism. Okay, what is Gnosticism? Well, again, like the mystery schools, there are many forms of Gnosticism. The Gnostic texts were actually early Gospels that appeared alongside the Gospels we all know in the early days of Christianity, in the first couple hundred years after Jesus. And they oftentimes took a different approach than Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And when the decision in the fourth century to codify the Christian religion, if you will, in terms of the four Gospels and the writings of St. Paul, these Gnostic Gospels were excluded. As a matter of fact, many of them were burned, and people hid them because they thought they would be burned if they were found. And some of our only knowledge of what was in them was due to an individual, Irenaeus, who in the second century wrote a lot of papers on what was wrong with Gnosticism, what was incorrect about these Gnostic Gospels. And then in the 1940s, they were found in a cave in Egypt, and that brought to light what these Gnostic Gospels actually were. And it really had a very different take than traditional Christianity. And I'm not going to get into a lot of this, but one of the main tenets of most Gnosticism is that the world was made in error, that it wasn't the divine plan. And just to speak to one of the books, the secret book of John, the Apocryphon of John, and again, I'm going to be very brief here. Basically, what this book says is that God is one being. It's a monad, but it exists through various aeons, and they come in a pair. And one of the pairs, one half of one of the pairs, Sophia, which means wisdom, decided to create on her own and didn't do it with her pair, and sort of went, broke bad, if you will. And she created her own sort of god, Ialdabaoth, which is then in turn created the world, which ended up being a bad place. And so the world was created in error, and the aeons recognized this. Sophia recognized this, that she had made a huge mistake, and a savior was sent, Christ was sent to repair things. So that's a very quick rundown of just one of the Gnostic texts. But the Gnosticism remained, and it had different forms, it had different takes. And I'm going to jump forward many, many centuries to the most recent, or a most recent Gnostic text, which is A Course in Miracles. And this was a book that was written in the 1970s by Helen Schuckman, who is a clinical psychologist in New York City. She claimed that she was, in fact, channeling this work, and it came to her as a voice. And it's very beautifully written. A lot of it's done in iambic pentameter. And although they don't make a big deal about this in the book, and it's actually hard to find in places, she did believe that the voice that was speaking to her was Jesus. So this was A Course in Miracles, and it was essentially a way to sort of course correct what was going on in the world and sort of give a new interpretation. And it's quite radical in its approach. And basically it teaches that the world, the world that we know was made as an attack on God, and that what we see around us of time and space and the finite world is just not real at all. And the only way to live in this world that we find ourselves in is to forgive. And it's basically you forgive other people for what they have not done, because the world is not real. So nothing's really happened here. And it's up to us to remember the true God. And they have an expression called the holy instant, which you sort of in a moment of time connect to God and to our eternal being within God. A spark within. Some of you may be familiar with Marianne Williamson. She's a best-selling author in the United States. She was also a presidential candidate in the Democratic field, and she attended a number of the initial debates. And she was put on the map by writing several books on A Course in Miracles, and was featured by Oprah Winfrey on her TV show and as a book recommendation, which really put her on the map. So that's A Course in Miracles. And again, it's Gnostic in the sense that it teaches that the world was made in error, the world's not real. And it's also mystical in the sense that you can, through the holy instant, reconnect with the heaven above. The third area that we'll be discussing is Jewish mysticism, otherwise known as Kabbalah. And there are two main books which are the basis of Kabbalah. One is the Zohar, and the other is the Sefer Yetzirah. The Zohar was written in the 12th century by one Moses de Leon, and he, interesting enough, believed he was channeling, actually, this book, and it was written in the 2nd century by Simon ben Yochai in Israel. But he channeled it, he wrote it, whether or not... this is true, who knows, But it became one of the cornerstone books of Jewish mysticism, Kabbalah. And if you study it, if you study portions of it, it relies heavily on the first book of the Bible, Genesis, and particularly the opening chapters. And it goes into incredible detail on the sentences, on the words, even the letters, and what they mean. And this is really what the Zohar concentrates on. And as Jewish mystics believe that by studying this, they can get closer to God and actually feel the presence of God within. The other major book of the Kabbalah is called the Sefer Yetzirah. And this is interesting. This was actually written in the second century AD. It's believed that it goes back all the way to Abraham, that God actually spoke to Abraham and Abraham wrote this down. So that's myth, obviously legend. But it's interesting. The Sefer Yetzirah talks about that there are 10 numbers and there are 22 letters. And the 22 letters can be identified as three mothers, seven doubles, and 12 simple letters. And there's a Hegelian correspondence here in that the numbers are considered ideal. They're true, but they're not real. And it's through the letters, through the word, that reality is created. And the leading proponent or scholar of Jewish Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, is an individual, Isaac Luria, who lived in Safad in Israel in the 16th century. He's known as the Ari, the Lion, and he's probably recognized by all as a leading Kabbalist. And he had a very interesting theory. He believed that in the beginning there was God, and in order to create the world, God had to first create nothing. This is sort of Hegelian in its approach. In other words, God had to actually shrink himself and create a space where he did not exist, and that there would just be nothing there. So that was the first effort that God did in making a world and fashioning a world. Now, it's also Gnostic in a sense that this world, I'll get into the story. Luria taught that once he created the space of nothingness, he then sent a ray of light, which is called Kav in Hebrew, and the space tried to incorporate it. The space, the cosmos at that time, tried to incorporate the light of God into it, but it failed. And the vessels, the Sephiroth at the time, could not handle it, and they broke. So the world broke into many, many pieces. And this is the world we find ourselves in today. And there's still a memory, though, of God that we have, even though the vessels of the original world broke. There's a memory of God, which is Rishimu in Hebrew. And this memory of God is similar to the Holy Spirit. It's similar to the divine, the Geist within us. And Luria taught that it's the purpose of Jews to repair the world. And the world is, the name for that is Tikkun. And through this repair, we do it through good deeds, which are mitzvahs. And that's how the rebuilding process, rebuilding the vessels to really fully contain the world of God, will manifest itself. So obviously this corresponds to Hegel with his concept of true infinity and the march of history. In the Kabbalah, they call the presence of God in the world the Shekinah, which is an interesting concept. And this is God's presence, God's infinite nature within the world. And through good deeds, through mitzvah, we can incorporate the spirit of God. And the Hebrew is Ruach HaKodesh. And there's an interesting quote, which is that it doesn't matter if someone is a man or a woman, Jew or Gentile, rich or poor, if they have Ruach HaKodesh, they will achieve the kingdom of heaven. And that's in the Hebrew Bible. And that's a very profound concept, I believe. So it's the Kabbalah is Gnostic in a sense, in that it says that the the vessels broke and there was a problem which needs to be corrected. But certainly it stands on its own as it's its own brand of mysticism. So those are the three major areas that I wanted to cover in terms of the Hermetic or Theosophical tradition, mystery schools, Gnosticism, and Kabbalah. And as we've seen, they all have some correspondence to this mystical notion of the God within, the master within, Geist within. Hegel, however, was he just promoting a mystery school? Was he just promoting Gnosticism? No. He offers something different. And I think the key thing here is it's a rationalization of this process, just like Fred Copleston stated. It's rational mysticism. Copleston also said, an interesting quote, he said that Hegelianism is esoteric Christianity and Christianity is exoteric Hegelianism, which is interesting. In Hegel, he justifies his mystical approach through rational thought. He leads you step by step in terms of how he arrives there. He is a philosopher, and this is what he is doing. He is showing this through his science of logic and his entire encyclopedia of the philosophical sciences. So, just to conclude, this is a review of Hegel and mysticism. We've seen clearly that there are elements of mysticism in Hegel's approach. We've examined three major areas of mysticism and have seen where they do correspond to Hegel. But also, all three of them have an element of belief and faith. And Hegel just works purely from the rational. And that's what I think separates him from these other traditions. He's clearly in the philosophy of in the tradition of Plato, Aristotle, and Kant. And to say that he's not a philosopher and he's just part of this Hermetic tradition, as McGee states, I don't think that's to be the case. But it's always good to find correspondences and other teachings, other wisdom teachings, and I will attempt to do this in further episodes. So once again, I want to thank you all for listening to these episodes. This is Greg Novak. Again, this is The Cunning of Geist, and we'll see you next time.